Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
January 15th, 2017. Episode 101, Hitching a Ride. Greetings, one and all, back one more time for another exciting episode of the Beekeeper's Corner with your host, Kevin England. Yeah. Hey, how you doing? All goofiness aside, thanks for tuning in. I'm in one of those moods. It's a typical January day outside, cold, frozen, ground dusted with snow. And I'm sitting in my basement man cave producing this bi-weekly effort and enjoying a quiet Sunday morning. I've had two cups of coffee, can you tell? Given the time of year, and considering that the apiary is quiet, this episode will be mostly segments and features. There are rare occasions, and this is one of them, where I simply haven't been out to the apiary to see the bees since the last report. So I don't have any meaningful local hive report for you. In fact, this week's local hive report is they're out in the yard and they're over at the farm. We'll check on them tomorrow. It's been a out early, home late week, and yesterday was packed full of activities and I simply didn't get out. I was hoping to before we got to the microphone today, but it's going to be tomorrow, folks. So we'll check on them tomorrow, and I'll let you know how that went in the next episode. And that being said, if you know and have listened to this program, my mind is in that thinking person's mode about what is going on. It's that time of year. Reflection on season past, on last year in particular, on all of those things you've been meaning to get to, and what will be the secret formula for beekeeping success in Nirvana this year? I did a really good job at taking notes at the end of the year and going through those and thinking about that. But my number one objective is all the equipment in my garage must be deployed this year. When I get to this time of year next year, the garage is going to be empty except for feeders and things like that. Yes, much to do, so little time to do it. So oddly, with the disclosure that there will be no local hive report this episode and the break with the norm, let me go ahead and tell you what we have in store for this episode so we can get right to it. Pollen selection. What do the bees prefer? And can we as humans figure that out? Hitching a ride. A surprising report on Varroa agility to mount a bee, and this one ain't pretty, folks. Vittles. Bees. It's what's for dinner. New bee species, boroscope, and beekeeping in January. Guidance and a bonus tip. There will likely be some other odds and ends sprinkled along the way. So prep yourself for an hour of beekeeping bliss, and let's go ahead and get started. Segment number one I call the confusing world of pollen selection. We all know bees visit plants and trees for pollen, nectar, and other resources that they use in the hive. Have we ever considered, however, that like a human has a preference in food, the bees likely have a preference for some sort of pollen? We are aware that some pollens are more nutritious than others. For example, I've repeated what I've heard in the past, that while goldenrod is in abundance in fall in our area, it is not necessarily the best pollen choice for bees because, well, it's not the most nutritious one available, especially when considering other options like the ones they get in springtime. In this segment, I'm going to provide a summary of some research where scientists explored the notion of pollen and specifically do bees respond to variations in pollen quality and discern one from another by choice. I got to get something out of the way. Let me temper your expectations and give you the outcome because I'm afraid that if I don't, I'll disappoint you. There's no punchline here. They simply don't know the answer yet. I ask you, though, don't despair. I'm going to take you through the various ways to break down the problem, and that in itself is fascinating and worth the effort. At least, I thought it was, and I'm banking that you do, too. Let me get a necessity out of the way. The research paper I'm going to reference was sourced from the British Ecological Society. The name of the paper is Plant-Pollinator Interactions from Flower to Landscape, Assessment of Pollen Rewards by Foraging Bees. It's sourced from the journal Functional Ecology, dated November 7th, 2016. Its credited authors are Elizabeth Nichols and Natalie Hempel de Ibarra. As I mentioned a second ago, well, the conclusion is, well, somewhat inconclusive, but kind of an odd thing to bring up a paper that doesn't have a punchline for a good finish at the end. But bear with me, as I think, as I said, you'll come to appreciate the journey much in the way that I did. So let's get started, shall we? I guess the first question is, do bees taste pollen when they collect it? Yeah, kinda, but not really. They don't eat pollen at the plant, not on purpose anyway. They do, however, have plenty of opportunities to come in contact with it and thereby taste the pollen. While feeling around the plant, the bees taste with their senses. Sometimes they even add fluids to the grains of pollen to get them to stay in their pollen baskets. So they might coat it and then shove it in the pollen basket and make it stick together with fluids, and therefore they get a little bit of a taste. A bee's sensory sensillae, the cells at the end of the sensory nerve fibers, have a gustatory, or taste, receptor that can sense some forms of taste, such as bitter or sweet. It is also known that their nerves can discern salt, water, carbonation, and a couple other things. Other insects have been proven to have sugar-sensitive receptors and receptors for proteins, but when it comes to bees, we're not quite sure how this all works yet, hence the paper. It has been demonstrated, however, that there is something to the selection, and it's been noted that bees will pick a substance with amino acids over simple sugar solutions when offered a choice. So they have gotten as far as being able to discern that bees can make a selection based on amino acids or some sort of profile that they're interested in. Given they can taste, so to speak, and presumably they taste the nectar as they bring it in, what about pollen? Turns out bees do not taste pollen in its dry state. Collected pollen in its dry state, according to research, did not seem to be perceived by honeybees when they tried to stimulate them with the odor of them. So let me explain that. You could go to a bee supply place, buy dry pollen, put it out, and it won't be a stimulus to the bee until it gets wet and gives off some sort of odor. When paired with some sort of sucrose reward, pollen does apparently seem to be distinguishable. Again, this appears to be something that they're working on, is trying to figure out how to entice them to the different pollens. And they're making progress, but they're not fully sure how to build the experiment to get the answer as to which pollens are more enticing. So they take the taste thing and they put it on the side and they say, well, if not driven by taste, or we can't discern that, what about odor? Bees can discern between the different odor of pollen, and specifically pollen versus the smell of the flower itself. They're distinct. And you think to yourself as a human, have I ever experienced the smell of pollen in some way? I always get the impression that in the fall when you walk up to your hive, if you have goldenrod at your disposal, that smell you get is from the pollen, not so much the nectar, but maybe I'm wrong. Don't know the answer to that, but I'm pretty sure it's the pollen itself. So bees can discern, and it's been noted in several studies that bees in controlled choice experiments have been found to be guided by the presence of their previously experienced pollen odors. In other words, if they've been out in the world and they've encountered some sort of pollen, they will possibly show a tendency towards that particular product. While it's true in the lab, there's no definitive answer from the lab as to if the odor of the pollen is driving selection in the real world. All they can tell is that they can discern one from the other. There is evidence in the field that bees can learn to associate a particular odor with the presence of pollen, but then again, it's cited as still inconclusive. In other words, they created some sort of lure for a specific kind of pollen, and they know that they can draw the bees into that particular plant, but they're not sure if they're drawn by the lure of the plant or the fact that they know they're going to have pollen there. Again, they're working these things out. So, not sure about taste, not sure about odor. What about size and feel? Maybe it's possible that the selection of pollen could be a more practical matter. Maybe it's picked because they're smooth or jagged, easier to carry, because of the size. Maybe it's the Goldilocks. This one's too small. This one's too big. This one's just right. Maybe they want a little one so that they can pack them in tight. Who knows? Maybe middle of the road is the way to go. One could also consider that nature provides a different path. Scientists do not have the luxury of going plant to plant to get the pollen that they want to test. They buy pollen, presumably fresh, from sellers who collected pollen obtained in some sort of commercial way. And what does that mean? Maybe the commercial guy is the problem, and this is why the experiments aren't working. Maybe they're taking pollen from a specific plant that's easier to get pollen from. And while they're shaking it out of the tree or getting it out of the flower, they're mixing it with something. Think about the foods that you eat. Sometimes there's stuff mixed in and it ruins it. We have no idea at the molecular level, what the bees are sensing. And could the person who's supplying commercial inadvertently be corrupting the samples? Don't know the answer to that. So perhaps they mix something in. Perhaps it's not the freshest pollen that they collected. Perhaps it has some sort of taint to it, a pesticide, or it's been sprayed or whatever, and the bees would have avoided it if they had encountered it. So many little factors, so little time, and no wonder this is a difficult thing to consider. At minimum, you might consider bee-collected pollen. You know, you set this thing up at the front entrance, and as the bee goes through, it knocks the pollen off, and you can collect pollen that way. If I'm a scientist, this isn't always an easy avenue because they have to be collecting pollen. And my understanding of it is a bee would go out to a specific plant and they would stay on that plant until they are done with it. They wouldn't be going to all these various pollen sources because they'd be going to goldenrod or some sort of aster or so on, right? It all adds up to making this reward system, which is so common in trying to figure out how bees behave, give them something they like against something they don't, and see if they can discern them. It gets a little murkier, and it's hard to reproduce some way to figure out what bees want in pollen in the lab. So where does that leave us? They're saying that pollen could be a multimodal stimulant. Maybe it's a combination of these things, taste, smell, visual appearance, freshness. All of those things play a role in what you're going to have the bee do. Perhaps there's a different way. Maybe we should look at what the bees can tell us. Bees will waggle dance for profitable food sources, including pollen. Researchers have been able to track dances for pollen itself, and even noted that bees will go for alternatives when real pollen is not widely available. So perhaps they go for surrogates such as flour, dry milk, even potato flour, something like that, that's available to them. I've heard people say that they've robbed out spackle paste at times when they were desperate. So all of these assessments add up to frustration for the researchers, and perhaps an equation to discern what bees really prefer is eluding us and will continue to. And maybe it's a combination of these tastes and odors and sizes and things, and that's going to make it even harder for the researchers to figure out. So the paper didn't have any decisive conclusions, but in a roundabout way, it laid the groundwork for the areas to poke and prod, and that's what I found interesting, and hopefully you did too. For a link to the paper,
Visit our show notes at www.bkcorner.org.
Segment 2, Hitching a Ride. There's a viral video for us beekeepers that has been making the rounds lately. Facebook, YouTube, and such. Perhaps you've seen it. A bee lands on a daisy, and like a horror movie for beekeepers, a varroa mite is waiting on the petal of the flower. Like a sprinter out of the gates at a track and field meet, the mite runs up the leg of the bee, crosses its abdomen, and nestles under the right wing of the poor foraging victim. It's dramatic footage, documented and brought to you by a study out of Cornell University. A paper was released December 12, 2016, in the journal PLOS ONE, and this video accompanied the release. The authors of the aforementioned paper, varroa destructor mites can nimbly climb from flowers onto foraging honeybees, were David T. Peck, Michael L. Smith, and Thomas D. Seeley, with James C. Nye as the editor. The experiment was conducted in 2014 and sought to understand if a mite could mount a bee from a flower, something that prior to this experiment was hardly observed nor quantified in a natural context. Ironically, as they stated in the paper, they had their doubts that they would learn anything. Quote, as the mites lack eyes and likely rely on their chemosensory forelegs to detect potential hosts, we began the study with a genuine doubt that a mite on a flower would be capable of the sensory discrimination and rapid acrobatics required to detect and mount a foraging honeybee before it flew away. End quote. What they came away with is probably a genuine surprise to many beekeepers, yours truly included. Let me take a moment to set the experiment up for you. They conducted the experiment in July 2014 at the Cranberry Lake Biological Station, which is owned by the New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. It is described in the paper as, nestled in an extraordinarily nectar-poor area of the Adirondack State Park in northern New York State, where forager bees are easily trained to visit experimental food sources. For the study, they prepared plants, daisies and echinacea flowers, with artificially rich sources, and because there was a scarcity of food, bees were eager to partake. They used sucrose solution scented with anise extract as the enticement for the bees. They sourced these bees from a colony of European honeybees, and ironically, they sourced the mites from the very same colony. They described the harvesting of the mites as follows, quote, we used the sugar shake method to obtain live phoretic stage mites. After removal from their bee hosts, each mite was removed from the powdered sugar with a toothpick, cleaned with chlorine-free water, examined for damage, and then placed in a shaded plastic container until being used in the experiment. Humidity in the container was maintained by a damp paper towel. No mite spent more than 2 hours in the container before being used in the trial. End quote. So I'm going to keep going and read the results verbatim, because they're too complicated to paraphrase. Right from the paper it says, of 31 mites placed on the glass feeder, 29 infested a bee. The two that did not were blown off the feeder by wind. In 12 of the 29 infestations, the bee immediately groomed herself, but in only 3 instances was the mite successfully dislodged. Consequently, 26 of the 31 mites, 84%, left the feeder attached to the bee. Of 43 mites placed on flowers, all 43 infested a bee, and almost every one, 41 of the 43, left the flower on a bee, on the bee it had infested. One mite fell off its forager, and one was groomed off. The average time taken by a mite placed on a flower to infest a foraging bee was
119 bee seconds. The most rapid infestation from a flower took only 2 bee seconds, while the longest took 840 bee seconds. I'm going to stop there because that's the end of the quote. I don't know what a bee second is, and I don't know that I found the answer to that. My guess is from the time the bee landed to the time the mite is, that's the seconds that they're talking about. It's a speculation on my part. As insightful as this data is, it's only the tip of the iceberg of the observations remarked in this study. The study goes through the mite behavior on the plants, how it positions itself, where it made its entry to the bee, meaning how it climbed on, how it behaved before, during, and after coming into contact with the bee.
One of the more interesting insights was how the mite was able to position itself rapidly to a place where the bee would have less success in grooming it off. Again, quoting the paper, most initial contacts with the bee's thorax and abdomen were with the ventral surface, meaning perhaps some of these infestations, first observed on the thorax and abdomen, may in fact have begun on the forager's legs, which were the most common sites of the first mite-bee contact. In every infestation, the first parts of the mite's body to make contact with the bees were the extended forelegs, and in many cases, mites were observed to latch onto a host with their forelegs and then rapidly flip their body upside down to bring the rest of their legs in contact with the host. End of the statement. There's a couple of things I stripped out of there just to make that readable. Like it had the timing of how quickly they flipped over. In that passage, there's a statement about the extended forelegs. The previous section of the paper indicated that mites would often position themselves on the leaf with their forelegs extended. And I will tell you that walking through the yard and seeing ticks in the yard that jump on a bee, jump on us as we're walking around, you'll see them standing on a plant with their legs up trying to grasp anything that goes by. That's a common deer tick I'm talking about. So one more tidbit to share with you, again, stating directly what was in the paper. This time it was about what the bee did just after being infested. We did not observe the bees perform conspicuous avoidance behavior towards the mites at the feeder or the flowers. The bees did, however, respond to the infestation. In many cases, foragers took off from the flower within 1 or 2 seconds of being infested. Of the 64 infestations in which we could evaluate grooming responses in real time or in the video recording, 20 bees, 31%, began grooming themselves at the feeder or flower, though only 4 of these grooming events led to the mites detaching from the bee. And in 3 of those 4 cases, the mite immediately mounted the same or nearby forager. One instance of allogrooming was observed on a flower, but the grooming bee failed to dislodge the mite from the groomed bee. That's the end of the statement. Allogrooming, by the way, if you're not familiar with it, it kind of led to what it means. It's a term where one bee grooms another. There's a lengthy conclusion in the paper that highlights some of what I've told you, observationally, and even more that I did not venture in. One concern emphasized is that the mite could stow away in any plant and be sent where no mites are known to exist and easily infect areas not impacted by varroa mites. You have to think about this as it goes both ways. Varroa mites, varroa destructor that we dislike, can go somewhere else, and varroa other kinds, like Tropilalops, the one everybody seems to be worried about, could come our way this way. This notion could be concerned to areas cited in the paper, Newfoundland, Iceland, and other regions that don't have mites yet. Studies cited in the research paper indicated that mites can survive in waiting, on flowers for as long as 6 days, depending on the type of flower.
So, yeah, unwittingly, a nursery could potentially harvest these mites and send them overseas. So what started out as a viral video to beekeepers led me down the path of a fascinating piece of research for sure. I don't have time to cover in depth all the findings in this report, so I would encourage you to take some time to follow our show notes link and add this to your reading list. There's so many cool things, every sentence. I barely scratched the surface on the depth of the findings detailed in the work. So kudos to the team. This was a home run given the findings and how they were doubtful that the setup would even work. Good stuff. Roundtable number one, vittles. Bears eat it, and so can you. We were eating breakfast Christmas morning, and somehow the topic came up of eating earthworms for extra credit in a high school science class. Also, there was a sidebar on the chocolate-covered crickets that Sharon bought the boys for their stocking as something of a novelty for Christmas morning. Different parts of the world eat grubs, worms, crickets, other kinds of insects and such. And I feel like it's only a matter of time before this becomes a thing in the United States. Call it a delicacy and label it artisanal, and we'll be paying more for it than what it's worth. In that equation, someone has to have the notion of eating honeybee larvae as a snack. You might be surprised to learn that it is in fact practiced elsewhere. According to an article featured on PHYS.org, PHYS.org website, eating honeybee larvae is considered a delicacy in several countries, including Mexico, Thailand, and Australia. The article states, quote, "It has a nutty flavor with a crunchy texture when eaten cooked or dried and is a versatile ingredient in soups and egg dishes. It also has a high nutritional value, similar to beef in terms of protein quality and quantity," end quote. As I think about it, we used to feed our cold drone brood to our chickens, and I've seen queen breeders scoop out eggs, deem them undesirable for the queen, and pop them in their mouth as a taste of royal jelly and egg. So will you have honeybee larvae mixed into your soup pretty soon? The article points out that there's some engineering that has to be overcome before this could become mainstream. For an analogy, think about how, actually, did they get a whole walnut out of a shell? How the heck did they do that? And if you think about that, if you've known anything about drone brood or other kinds of brood, it's going to be a challenge to harvest the brood. In my experience, it's really fragile and mighty messy when you pop one. They ooze all over the place. The article goes on to say that they have to be handled properly also, as they will go rancid if not stored correctly, given they have high fat content. I'm not sure what we would think about eating normal brood, but I could see a world of drone brood factories. Question is, would we mix the varroa mite in there too? Wouldn't that be justice for mite control? Come to think of it, it just dawned on me that maybe you cook the frame whole, melt the wax, and cook the larvae at the same time. I'll have to write into somebody for that. I think we're going to have to ponder this situation and see if a frame of brood comes my way sometime this summer. Sounds like a good podcast topic, how I cook some drone brood. Nicely toasted, little olive oil sprinkling of seasoned salt. Yummy. For a link to the article, "Could Honey Bee Brood Be the Future of Food?" visit our show notes. Roundtable number two, new ant-like bees discovered. A discovery of 9 newly identified species of bees has been made in Utah in the ecosystems of the American Southwest, including the sands of Death Valley in California. I thought it interesting that they say these bees forage in the main heat of the day, something that the researchers hypothesized is to avoid predators. The bees appear to have adaptions or characteristics, according to the article, that make them unique. They are shaped so they can go into very small flowers and have an adaptation called a hair basket that resembles a cluster of hairs on the back of their head, just behind the eyes and antenna. From what I gather, the bee sticks his head far into the flower, and the hairs collect the pollen as the bee dives in or retracts. Scientists aren't sure if simply the bees going in and out that does the deed, or they use their legs to coerce the pollen to that location just behind their eyes. The other distinction that they noted was different markings on the bees. They were observed to have certain kind of stripes or spots and different patterns that you're used to, and scientists feel could be for camouflage or for some form of mimicry of some other fly or insect. Kevin moment. I never thought about that, that bees have stripes for camouflage. Have you ever considered that notion? I suppose if I were something that likes to eat bees, I would just hang out at flowers and wait to pick them off. I'm not sure why it never dawned on me, but interesting notion nonetheless, camouflage. Yeah. Why do bees have stripes? End of Kevin moment. So the article had a couple pictures. It's hard to discern from the size, as bees can range from a speck to as big as your thumb and everything in between. But these appear to be, based on the video I watched, smaller than a typical honeybee, but longer and narrower, somewhat bullet-shaped, like some of the wasps that I've seen. It would make sense since they are going into a flower similar in shape to a trumpet vine flower. Long, narrow, bell-shaped flowers, but described as really small. So not the most earth-shattering news, because apparently there are tons and tons of bees that are undiscovered out there, but always neat to know that they find some more. The article is Ant-like bees among new desert species identified by USU entomologist. There's a link at the show notes.
Roundtable number 3. I call this one boroscope. I think I'm going to bore a hole. Right here. While no longer with us, my Uncle Tom was this really cool guy, and I remember my twin brother and I when they used to babysit us. We were toddlers, and he used to play this game with us, the one that I just did, where he would take his pointer finger and put it up in the air and wiggle it all around and then eventually sneak in and tickle you. I remember playing that game with my kids, emulating a bee sting. It was always fun. You know, we used to giggle when he did that. And I started reading a little bit about a camera that you could purchase at home that couples with your phone, and it has the head that's designed to be inserted into some small space, say a drain pipe or in a combustion chamber of a motor engine. These cameras are often referred to as endoscopes, or in the case of a mechanic's viewpoint, they're called borescopes. I like the word boroscope. I don't know why. I just always call it that. So if you hear me interchange that, it's just a little Kevinism. So that draws the connection to the, I think I'm going to bore a hole, because that's what it conjured up when I saw the name boroscope. Yeah, it's a little weird on my part how my mind works. I know. A little Kevin moment there. So anyway, Bob Close was the local guy in our area, being like-minded in the pursuit of gadgets, that had bought one of these last year, I think it was, and talked about it a bunch of different times. And I finally decided it would be neat to have one of my own. It was driven by the FLIR use to determine whether a hive is alive, the other way that we said, beyond using stethoscopes and other things, is one of these boroscopes where you literally put it up inside of a hive and see whether the bees are alive or not. So I was in quest of picking one of these up. Bob and I are going to cover the FLIR camera and the endoscopes at our association meeting coming up here in January. And I purchased one, and it arrived this week, and I've been busy, haven't had a chance to look at it until a little bit ago yesterday. So it's a 3-day weekend, and I hope to get out and see the bees. I haven't had a chance, and using it tomorrow. Bob got his model that works with his Android phone, and it only works with an Android phone. So when I went shopping for one, I was looking for something a little bit different. I have an Android phone, a Windows phone, and an iPhone, but I use the iPhone as my daily driver, so I was looking for one that would work with that. And I was also looking for different technology. I haven't seen Bob's, but I knew what I wanted was one with a stiffer cord that you could shape. It would hold its shape, and then when you inserted the probe into your hive, the camera wouldn't flop over. And the other thing I wanted was, there's two different technologies that I saw for these. One of them drives from the phone itself, and the other one uses a small Wi-Fi box receiver as part of the camera that lets you connect to the camera in a Wi-Fi sense. I'll talk about that more in a second here. So the model I purchased was a little more expensive than Bob's. The brand name is Sansido, S-A-N-S-I-D-O. They have different lengths of cords. I really didn't want one super long. Since I'm only going in a beehive, it is really my intended purpose for it. So I bought the 1 meter borescope. It has a 2 megapixel camera with 6 LEDs to light what the camera is filming. It has 720p resolution. And as I said, I bought the Wi-Fi model. So Sansido 1 meter borescope, 2 megapixel camera with 6 LED and 720p Wi-Fi. That's a little bit of a mouthful. Let me break that down and describe the device. It has a little camera end that's about the size of a Bic pen cap. You know, the square caps that cover the pen so that you don't get ink on your pocket. And you can hang it from your pocket with that little tabby thing. It's about that size. It has a short dual micro USB cable that connects a little matchstick size white aluminum box that in turn connects to the cable that has the camera on the other end that's 1 meter long. Let me talk about the couple cables. The short cable is a micro USB cable. It has micro B on both sides. One end connects to the micro USB connector on the little matchstick box, and the other one connects to your cell phone. And the point of this thing, I'm gathering, is that it powers the Wi-Fi server that's inside that little box. In my case, I didn't want to have my phone tethered to the box, which was tethered to the camera. I wanted to hold the camera in one hand and hold the phone in the other hand and separate the two if I wanted to, or give somebody else the phone so that they could see what's being probed and so on. So the good news is that little power cord can be plugged into a little power bank. You know, I have those Anker power banks, the small ones. They're a little cylinder. They contain a couple batteries. And if you go out to New York City for the day and you want to have a spare battery pack so you could charge your phone midway through the day while you're using it, they work perfect for this. So you picture this little battery pack, the small, about 3-4 inch cord, this little tiny matchbox, and then the 1 meter cable. Not a bad setup. And then your phone in your pocket, or however you're going to deal with it. So as I alluded to, the difference in this design, from what I could tell from the one Bob has, which I haven't seen yet, is Bob relies on his phone and the app to operate the camera. This one has a Wi-Fi server that your phone connects to, like connecting to any Wi-Fi network. It broadcasts. And my gather that I've tested is that you could walk around in the house, it'll still receive that signal, so you can get pretty far away from the box. You connect to the Wi-Fi server, and then the app just reads the information that way. So I think in Bob's case, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm not. Again, I'll see it when I see his camera. You literally have to have it connected to the phone for it to operate the camera, and you'll be tethered to the phone. So a couple things to describe about what this thing looks like so you can envision it. On the 3 meter cable, there's a little pod near the end. Not unlike something you'd see on a pair of earbuds where you can change the volume and whatever. It has a dial on it, and that dial allows you to adjust the brightness of the lights. It also has a button on it, which I don't know yet what it does, just cursorily played with the thing, but I did dial the dial and I can make the light bright all the way to its top setting of number 6 or dial it back to a softer light and in between. So that's going to really come in handy, of course, because inside the hive it's dark and you need to have the light settings. I'm fairly versed on technology, so I knew the research on how to set this thing up. It didn't come with any instructions. Seems pretty straightforward, but if you're the non-technical type, it might take you a little bit to figure this thing out. There are a few steps to follow to configure your phone to work with this. And then the app that accompanies the device, which again, really didn't come with any instructions, so to speak. I'd done some recon on the thing in order to purchase it, so I understood its basic mechanics. In summary, you download the application from the App Store, whether it's Android or iOS. No Windows Phone app yet. You provide power to the camera device through the little cable that I talked about. It transmits a Wi-Fi signal. You open your phone, go to your Wi-Fi settings, and connect it to your Wi-Fi. And no, you cannot connect to two Wi-Fis at once. So if you're in your house, you have to switch off your house Wi-Fi and connect to this thing. Just an aside there. And once you connect, then you can open the app, and the app recognizes the camera, and as you operate the app, you can see whatever the camera is seeing when it's powered on. So voila, the camera is showing on the screen of your device, iPhone, iPad, Android phone, or some other i/Android tablet, whatever you have. Again, you could be noted that I did not say Windows tablet there. It's probably not much of a platform because most people are carrying iPhone and Android in their pocket, and not much of a problem, I should have said. But it's too bad for me, right, because I know I have a couple Windows tablets. I have a really nice Lenovo 9-inch lightweight tablet that would have been perfect for this. So I should say that I'm really early into understanding this thing. There might be a possibility that Windows is available because I saw other variants of this particular model and it indicated that Windows was an option, but I don't know how to get the software for the tablet for that. Given that I'm going to use this with the device that's in my pocket out in the field, it's going to be my iPhone. I'm not going to really pursue this, but my inclination is to think that, yeah, there might be a Windows version of this somewhere down the line if there's not one already. So on that note, I'll take a short sidebar on this. It applies to this solution and the FLIR camera that I reviewed last episode. There's one thing that I wasn't aware of with these things. They seem to be pretty open utility-wise. Sir Kloss and I were talking about our FLIRs, and he had more time to explore this. So he filled me in that you can use other software with these devices and not just the FLIR software that comes with the FLIR camera. Case in point is there are a number of apps on the iPhone store that are free or you can buy that work with the FLIR camera and duplicate the camera operation software, sans the FLIR logo, by the way, which is one of the things I was hoping to solve. And they bring different features or functions depending on the software that is written. I suspect, given what I learned about that it also applies to these camera systems, that the input from the camera can probably be leveraged against other endoscope, borescope software solutions that are out available on the App Store, but I don't know the truth of that yet until I look a little further. So the big question is, how did the camera work? I only did a test run in my kitchen so far and used it to explore the inside of my closed kitchen cabinets and such. I stuck it in the coffee cup cupboard. Say that 10 times fast. Coffee cup cupboard, coffee cup cupboard, coffee cup cupboard. And I could explore the coffee mugs in there and clearly read the writing on several of them. The camera has a sweet spot on the focus, and I was happy to see the longer view was good enough for me to understand what I'm looking at. In the close-up view was pretty cool, especially when I dialed the lighting. So as I said, it comes with 6 lighting settings, and I did dial the value of the lighting back when looking at a white coffee mug because it was overexposed when I was looking at it, and as I rolled it back, it dialed the contrast down, and I could read the writing right on the mug. So it's a bit disorienting looking at a screen and operating a camera into something that you can't see and figuring out move right, move left, do whatever, and then dialing the light. So it does take a little bit of practice with this thing, but that light is important for you to understand what you're looking at on the phone and helps you dial in the focus of it, so to speak. I don't know if the camera works by the amount of lighting available to it or not, but I kind of was like, you know, why would you ever use this thing other than on the brightest setting when you're sticking it in a pipe or whatever? But now I get the gist of the different variations of light settings. And making the light setting a little duller actually made it more comprehensible. So later today, or more likely tomorrow, I'm going to wander out to the hives and start probing. So there are a few closing thoughts to share and revisit. I talked about the rigidity of the wire and its ability to hold the camera head. It's too flimsy, the one I bought, and it flops right over, which was a disappointment. As I said, I saw Bob yesterday and we talked about this and discussed a homemade modification to remedy the problem. And we were both going to take a shot at it and see if we can come up with a solution for that prior to our January meeting. We talked about ideas about wrapping the wire in another wire to give it more rigidity, or using some plastic braiding that's intended to hold a bunch of wires together. I know that I have this really funny, unusual aluminum wire. It was something that my father-in-law had when I bought the house. I found it. It's really pliable. It stays exactly as you bend it. And it's extremely lightweight. And I know I have 3 meters of this somewhere, and it would be absolutely perfect for this. So my thought is I'm going to take that, map it up to it, tape it in a couple spots every couple inches, and then I'll have the perfect pliability to be able to shape the thing in whatever way I want for whatever my destination is. So on the Amazon website, I did see that someone asked if the cable was rigid enough to hold the camera head up in the questions. But I missed that because I didn't see that when I was doing my research. And it indicates from the manufacturer that they're updating the camera model and the new version will come with stiffer plastic to address this. That was posted in late December. So it's too bad I missed it, but so it goes. Another thing I learned while reviewing this model and watching some videos of people using it is that little short dual-sided micro USB cable that comes with it goes one way, meaning if you plug it into your phone and you plug it into that little control box and it doesn't light the camera up connected on the other side, switch it around. For some reason, the power passes through one way. I'll tell you that I didn't really like those connectors on that thing. They seemed really grabby and stiff, and I was worried that they were not inserting cleanly and damaging my phone or whatever. I'm wondering if they'll, sometimes they need to break in. You have those micro USBs that are really catchy in the beginning, and sometimes some of those just always suck no matter how long you use them. I should add that micro USB is micro USB to micro USB, so I'm not sure how they intended you to power this thing using an iPhone, unless you had some micro USB to lightning connector. And that didn't come in a box, but in my case, my recommendation would be to do what I said, is to have one of those little battery packs, and then you'll be good for forever. So I'm happy to have the holiday on Monday, as it will allow me some time to play with this in more detail. I'm going to go out and try and shoot some videos, see how it works. As usual, it's busy at work. Had a couple work calls yesterday. Got some scheduled for today, probably at least one on Monday, even though company is closed. We have something that has to be ready for Tuesday morning when we return, so such is the life of the glamorous life of a software engineer. One of the things I'm really excited about is to see how the top bar is doing. Going over the farm, keeping my fingers crossed that all the hives are alive, and I'm looking forward to putting the probe in there and because I never really got to see what the top bar looked like inside. I tried not to disturb it too much late in the fall and keep it closed. So here I'll be able to inspect it from the bottom up, which I think is interesting. And I will tell you that it had a screen bottom board or screen opening on the bottom of the V-shape on my top bar. And I laid on the ground and tried to shine a light through the screen to see what the comb looked like. Now I have a probe that I could go in and see how the structure looks from underneath without opening the hive. So that's kind of cool. I really didn't like the concept of a unitasker. So I'm interested to see how this plays out over the beekeeping season, whether it provides any utility. I'm wondering about the solution that Bob said. If you put it in, the bees will all clump on the thing, but we'll see how that goes as you get more experience with it. Oh, I don't know that I mentioned that. Bob did tell me that the one time he used it, he put it in the hive, and I guess the bees got defensive on that, got on it, and then all of a sudden all the bees are on it, and when he extracted it out of the hive, an angry clump of bees came, and he said, don't do that. So that, keep in mind that, now is a good time to do it. The bees are on the cluster. They're generally going to stay there. They might defend the thing, who knows. But when they're operational, it could be possible that you might want to have a suit on as you experiment with those things. So my intention is to prep for our upcoming association meeting where Bob and I are going to be presenting these things. And, of course, in the Kevin mindset, I'm going to look to see if I can build some sort of video feature that we can put up on the YouTube channel. Borescope, endoscope, whichever term you want to use it, a toy to play with, and another gadget to consider for beekeeping, and keep an eye posted. I'm sure I'll have some more follow-ups on this in time to come. And we'll look to see if we could probably film that session that Bob and I are going to give in January, so you'll get to follow up with that too. Roundtable number 4, beekeeping in January. I intend to serve a dual purpose with this roundtable. I'm going to share an overview of beekeeping activities as outlined in the NJBA calendar and do a little promotion for it. It gives me the opportunity to share the link to the calendar that you could purchase that has a guide like this for every month, so it's a little advert for it. It's adorned with the New Jersey Beekeepers Association photos for beekeeping settings, equipment, bees, and such. And it's really an amazing effort that I try to plug every year. I have a link on the show notes, but we'll tell you to consider having a pen or pencil handy and something to write on, and I'll give you a link somewhere near the end verbally of this roundtable. First off, there's a recommendation for a link to a beekeeping app on January's page. Bee Health is like a field guide for beekeepers that you can have in your pocket. It was developed by our friends to the north, the Alberta Agricultural and Forest Organization of the Government of Alberta. It serves to help beekeepers detect, identify, manage, and treat honeybee diseases and pests. I often see a lot of field guides, like a little paper-based thing that they give you, and I have one in my kit, but it seems to me that this thing's somewhat equivalent of that type of thing, but always in your pocket on your phone, which, of course, being a web and mobile guy, makes sense to me from a consumption standpoint. So from a tip standpoint, going in the order on the calendar, it's time to reserve your packages and or nukes for the spring. If you haven't gotten to that, or you're new and don't know that, now is the time for people to place their orders. So do that now to ensure that you are going to be able to get an order in the spring. During the long nights, it's a good time to order and prep any equipment you need for spring. Spring's going to be here before you know it. Check in on your hives like I'm going to do tomorrow. Midwinter check, just make sure the lids are well secured, that there's no moisture problems. They have sufficient resources if they were a little light. It's okay to lift the inner cover and peek in. But don't tear apart the hives. You're going to break all the seals. I always preach that. And let all the heat out. If you take the top cover off and you see them clustered up underneath the hole there, chances are they're functional. If your bees have not made it this far, and I know someone told me yesterday one of their hives didn't make it, seal them off. You know, presumably bees die this year from a lack of something and not disease, but better safe than sorry. If there's a warm day somewhere in our future, you can guarantee that any flying hives will be probing everything else to see what's out there, and an open dead hive is rife for stealing whatever's in there, and if there's something bad, it's going to go back to your healthy colony, so close them up. It's that time of year, especially in New Jersey. Register your hives online. It keeps you on notice should there be a disease outbreak in your area. It provides more funding for beekeepers when the census shows how many hives there are in the state of New Jersey. It affords you the ability to have an apiarist visit if you have some sort of beekeeping challenge in your future. If you're not registered, I don't think he's going to want to come see you. And I'll have a link in the show notes on where to go to look up the New Jersey Division of Agricultural Bee Inspection page, where you'll find the registration process. The URL just is not something I can convey verbally. Last but not least, consider if you need some feeding recipes or you want to feed yourself on some recipes. What I mean is, in the back of the calendar, last page, there are some recipes to make food for bees. And you can always visit honey.com to make food for humans. Now, I told you I would share a link to the calendar. Visit the New Jersey Beekeepers Association website. It's www.njbeekeepers.org. When you go there, you can visit the store and you'll see the calendar for sale for $11.70. I have no idea why they have such an odd amount to purchase. Maybe it's for shipping. By the way, you could simply get it right directly by going to the store link at njbeekeepers.org/store. Oh, and that meeting I've been promoting that we're having, the two-day seminar that New Jersey Beekeepers Association is putting on, is available for purchase there in the store too. One more roundtable number 5 to sneak in. Fixed. A listener posted a comment on our guest book that indicated there was a problem with episode number 81 from our catalog. Sven from Uppsala, Sweden, thanks for the note. You were correct. It appears the upload somehow became corrupt. I've reposted the original MP3 file back out there, and it should be right with the world. Thanks for tipping me off, as I didn't know of the problem until you sent over a note. So if anybody was listening to the back catalog and found that episode 81 was kaput, it is now functional again. So I'm to the bottom of the pile of what we had to cover this go-around. I wanted to offer a couple of closing comments. I'm hoping to take in the 7th Annual Natural Beekeeping Symposium. It's going to be held at Temple University Gittes Student Center in Philadelphia. Bob Kloss and I went to that last year. It's going to be February 4th. I know there's also a seminar coming up in Westchester, which I'm going to look to attend. Looking forward to that. And, of course, the meeting I just mentioned a moment ago about the New Jersey Beekeepers Association today will be at that. We've planned out our menu of meetings for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association. January 27th, 7 p.m., Hunter and Central High School. Bob Kloss and I will be covering those cameras that I talked about. We'll have our Arnia hive monitoring system on hand to show people what that is. This year we're doing a honey tasting series where every meeting we're going to have a honey tasting and use the sheets that we developed, and then any Q&A that beekeepers want. One other thing beekeeping going on these days. Yesterday we started in on our adventure to build a demonstration bee cage for our fairs. We've always borrowed the bee cages that we've used for the work that we've done for Northwest, and decided it was time to embark on building one. So we got the plans, or at least took dimensions off the state one, and we're going to build our own. So Jim Schmalz and I are working on that, and a number of people from the association are going to drop in and help here and there. And we're going to document the process so others can build their own bee cages. And you'll probably hear me talk about some coverage of that in the coming episodes as we make progress for that. So all kinds of stuff going on. Isn't this fun, everybody? Beekeeping 24/7 here. So beekeeping 24/7, and that's good. Keeps us going here. We'll have something to talk about in the next 2 weeks. So time to sign off. I'll leave you with, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well. Have a good week.